But in essence, what we did was to pull together a rather interdisciplinary team of psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, sociologists, and we planned to do a basically exploratory study to find out who the hippies were, where they had come from, what had led to their dropping out, what their psychological status was, what their experiences were day to day on the streets, what their drug experiences were, how they felt about them, what their plans for the future were. And then perhaps the most important part of the study was to follow them for a number of years to see whether this was a transitional kind of thing for them or whether it actually involved a major change in lifestyle that would remain over a period of years. And also to see, at that time there were great speculations about what the chronic effects of drug involvement might be. And of course we were interested in finding out whether there would be any either beneficial or adverse consequences resulting from their very heavy drug involvement.
When you started this, this was looked at mainly as a passing phenomenon, wasn't it?
Not entirely. There were some people who were very concerned that perhaps the advent of psychedelic drugs and a radically different kind of lifestyle would actually lead to the destruction of a generation. There were all sorts of doomsday thinkers who were afraid that that youngsters from a relatively privileged and elite stratum of society would essentially be throwing their lives away by getting involved in this kind of thing. There were others who felt that it was a passing phenomenon, perhaps yet another instance of adolescent rebellion or faddish kind of behavior. And I think that in all honesty to those concerned, that the National Institute of Mental Health was responding to their ignorance about the problem. They just didn't know what its dimensions were, what its portents were, and we were funded to try to find out for them.
How did you go about doing this? How many people were involved in this study?
We established a research headquarters in the heart of the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood, and based there were a team of at times up to 25 professionals and research assistants and secretaries who were involved with the study. At first, we thought that it would be very hard for us to find subjects for the research. We were told that the hippies would be very wary of any establishment-based research, that they would be reluctant to talk with us. And so we planned quite carefully for recruiting them. We had research assistants out on the streets, and we had formed liaisons with the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic and with the Switchboard and Huckleberries and a variety of other self-help groups and organizations in the neighborhood. We found, however, much to our delighted surprise, that the people in the neighborhood were very, very willing to talk to us. They weren't uptight about confidentiality or anonymity. They didn't. In fact, we were probably more concerned about it than they were. We would encourage people to approach us with some caution to find out about us before they really agreed to cooperate, but we were just flooded with subjects. We found it was much more difficult to get people to stop talking about themselves than to begin.
How many of these people were you actually able to keep in touch with over this period of years?
Well, over the first 2 years of the study, we began with an initial sample of about 250 who actually completed the initial intake assessment that we had planned. And that was rather strenuous kind of thing. It involved some 30 hours of interviews and tests and informal kinds of contacts. And overall, we maintained contact with slightly over 70% of them over a four-year period. It would require a book in its own right just to talk about the logistics of that follow-up. I think you know that our major finding is that compared to the way they appeared at the time the study began, the vast majority of our subjects looked considerably straighter at the end of 4 years.
You say they looked straighter, but what about their beliefs? Their
Well, we looked at both kinds of things. When I say they look straighter, what I mean is that if you consider those characteristics that first attracted so much attention to the hippies, their style of dress, their personal appearance, their drug use, their relations with family, their interpersonal relationships, in almost all regards, they were straighter. That is, they tended to be employed or in school. They tended to be dressed more like the average person of their age rather than in some more exotic or bizarre fashion. Drug use was dramatically reduced for the entire sample. There were some exceptions, which I'll talk about later. Nonetheless, in the majority of cases, their attitudes and beliefs and values remained very strongly influenced by the psychedelic vision, if you will, or by a kind of bitterness or cynicism about the American way of life, but probably not nearly so dramatically at the end of 4 years, as not so dramatically different from the majority of youngsters as they were at the beginning of the study. Well, here I guess is a good time to introduce the idea that there are really three groups within our sample, and we refer to them as the re-entry group, the semi-re-entry group, and the non-re-entry group. And I think we have to talk about the three groups differently. The re-entry group are those who either weren't affected very much at all by their involvement, or who actually benefited to some extent from it. Not surprisingly, these were the kids who psychologically were most intact, were most together at the time that the study began. They tended to come from families that were very strongly supportive of their independence, that encouraged them to be independent and to explore on their own. And they entered into the hippie scene with a very strong ideological quest, got what they wanted out of it, some with some disillusionment, and basically left it relatively unscathed. Shifting to the opposite extreme, the non-reentry group, are those who came from the most disturbed kinds of families, were the most psychiatrically disturbed at the time that the study began, and who in the course of our follow-up study became even more heavily committed to being dropouts. Many of them turned to the use of amphetamines or heroin. Some of them are still very heavily involved with LSD, although that's a minority of the group. And then there's the group between those, those who have neither dropped back in to any significant extent, nor have they gotten more seriously involved. And these are perhaps the most interesting and in some ways the most tragic of the three groups. These are the ones who are living a very marginal kind of existence on the periphery of society. The majority of them are on welfare, or they're significantly underemployed. They don't really want to be challenged or hassled. These are kids who, at any other time in the history of our society, would probably have fared very, very well. But in a sense, things were too much for them. The world was too much with them. They could have survived in times of less stress, but they've not been able to survive very well in times of maximal stress. And they're the ones who cannot fully drop back in, as the reentry group did, but they have it too much together to really let themselves completely go.
Which of these groups did you find to be the largest? Which was the most predominant?
The reentry group was the largest. It was slightly more than 35% of our sample, about 40%. The non-reentry group was the smallest. So, you know, if you want to think of it in better or worse terms, the outcome for the majority of the subjects was more favorable than unfavorable.
You referred to this study group, I believe, as one of the most unique groups of persons ever studied. Well, what exactly did you mean?
Well, what I meant there was that if you look at them as a group of social deviants, okay, which in some sense they are. They were focused on because they were using drugs that were illegal, so it's not unfair to say that they were deviant in that sense. They're totally unlike any other deviant group that's ever been studied. They have almost nothing in common with the typical juvenile delinquent. They have almost nothing in common with the young alcoholic or the young heroin user. They, you know, as I mentioned before, they're a predominantly white, middle and upper middle class group. They had an average IQ of 119. They had completed an average of a year in college at the time of their dropping out. Their parents were employed, well, their father, 90% of their fathers were employed in white collar or professional kinds of jobs. Those of their mothers that worked were mostly teachers and secretarial kinds of positions. Average family income at the time that they were seniors in high school was about $15,000. So, you know, they just aren't the kinds of kids that you would have expected to drop out. And I think this is one of the reasons that such inordinate attention was focused on them, that, you know, it doesn't, I mean, drug use, for example, in America has long been a problem, but it's been a problem that's been on the other side of the tracks. It's been an endemic problem in black and minority communities and ghettos throughout the country, and nobody much cared about it. It was when it began to affect the white middle and upper middle class kids that there was a huge governmental response and community response of concern. Well, let me focus on three results. First, thinking about the follow-up study, the most interesting result is also the most trivial. Namely, that the outcome that we observed in terms of social and psychological adjustment following their involvement in the Haight-Ashbury culture was almost entirely determined by how intact they had been at the time that they entered the study. Those kids who were the most together or intact ended up that way. Those who were the most disturbed at the beginning of the study ended up that way. So that the great concerns about a whole generation being wasted by psychedelic drugs was hardly the case. In fact, neither our study nor any others have really shown any chronic impairment resulting from the use of these drugs. And remember, we started with a group of kids who were very seriously committed. I mean, at the time that we began working with them, they averaged between 100 and 150 LSD experiences each. Okay, so that's one, I think, important kind of study, which allows us to put the whole phenomenon into some kind of perspective, and really suggests to parents who express that kind of concern that if they trusted their kids and trusted the kind of upbringing that they had had prior to that sort of adolescent involvement, that the consequences aren't that much to be feared. Second finding, which is of, I think, great importance, is that in trying to account for why this elite or privileged group of youngsters dropped out and got so heavily invested in psychedelic drugs, I've mentioned one factor, namely their sense of being special or different or outcasts. But the more important finding was that these are kids who, despite their middle class or upper middle class heritage, had unusually traumatic middle childhoods. That is, the middle childhood period from the time a kid is from, say, 6 to 12, from the time they begin school until the beginning of puberty, are usually seen as a time of relative tranquility. That's a time when, because they're not bothered by a lot of social demands upon them, and because they've broken some of the dependency on the family and are more involved in a peer culture through school, and because they're no longer involved in the kind of rapid biological changes that take place before age 6 and again in puberty, that this is a time of relative freedom where kids can grow tremendously, where they can, through their interests and activities and schoolwork and hobbies and daydreams, they can explore the world and learn all of the tools that they will need to help them become mature adults. And almost every theorist agrees that if this so-called latency period or middle childhood period is not a time of great tranquility, that the kinds of development that has to go on at that time will be interfered with. And I guess the single most important finding of our study is that our subjects were most unusually stressed during this supposedly benign period of life. And it wasn't any one particular kind of stress or family upset, but rather they tended to move a lot. Families tended to break up a lot. Children were born. All sorts of untoward incidents occurred in their life. So rather than being a time of greatest freedom from stress, it was a time of greatest stress. And this has proved in our study to be a very important determinant of subsequent outcome. I guess the last thing that I should mention is the way different people respond to psychedelic drugs. And here again we found that by looking at people's reactions to drugs and what they said about them, that we could make some very accurate predictions about what would subsequently happen to them. For example, those subjects who described their first LSD experience as one of great visual beauty or perceptual beauty, but who didn't elaborate very much on that in terms of spiritual or mystical kinds of experience, that those were the ones who were most likely to give up all drug use subsequently. It was for them a pleasant and enjoyable experience, but it wasn't a need-gratifying kind of experience. They didn't make too much of the experience. And they largely lost interest in the drugs when it stopped being a unique kind of thing for them. Those who perceived their first LSD or their best LSD experience to be one of involving some kind of spiritual awakening were the ones who were most likely to continue the use of psychedelic drugs only. Those who experienced on their LSD experiences a sense of calm or nirvana or a feeling of escape from pain and nothing much more are the ones who most likely got into either heroin or barbiturate use subsequently. And finally, those who reported in their LSD experiences a great sense of energy, of excitement, who focused more on the rate at which new ideas came into their mind rather than on the ideas themselves, were the ones who subsequently were most likely to get into either cocaine or amphetamines. In short, the psychedelic experience was almost like a projective test in its own right, that in describing the experiences that they liked to have, people in effect were telling you what kinds of drugs they would eventually seek to produce those experiences. I guess those are really three of our most important findings.
Did you deal at all with the use of marijuana in this culture? Did that have any effect at all?
Well, we couldn't really deal with that because marijuana was a backdrop against which all other drug experiences took place. The average pattern of drug use for our subjects was daily use of marijuana, interspersed with more sporadic use of other drugs, usually psychedelics. Most of our subjects had experimented with 10 to 12 different drugs, usually in the first couple of months of their drug involvement, and then tended to stabilize into fairly stable patterns of drug use. At the beginning of our study, that was almost exclusively psychedelic. That is, although about a quarter of our subjects had used harder drugs at the beginning of our study, this is usually a once or twice kind of experience, and at the time that we selected them for study, they were using just marijuana and LSD.
And the use of marijuana, did you find that this continued over this period of time? Did people react to this as they did with the psychedelic drugs and just left it, or did you find that this stayed with them?
One of the criteria for being in the reentry group was the termination of all drug use except occasional marijuana use. About a third of our subjects, a little over a third of our subjects fell into that group, and I would say that about half of them had terminated all drug use, including marijuana. The remaining half of that reentry group continued to use marijuana, but considerably less than they had at the beginning of our study.
Okay, as far as the uses of the study you've done, the practical uses, what do you see as being a contribution this will make?
Well, I think that along with some other work that's been done over the years, it makes a considerable contribution to the whole question of what sorts of treatment, if any, people should be given for certain types of drug use. In fact, directly from the study resulted a procedure that we developed to determine the nature and extent of a person's drug involvement and the treatments that are best suited to that. A lot of our findings are of particular theoretical kinds of interest, such as the prediction of subsequent drug use from early LSD experiences, which haven't been used in an applied sense very much, but which certainly have potential for that. Perhaps the most important applied finding of our study is that we have a great tendency to lose perspective when studying a so-called deviant group. And I think what we failed to look at seriously enough at the beginning of our study, but which subsequently came to be very important, were the kinds of street survival skills that people had, the kind of competencies that people manifest in their everyday life, that rather than focusing on the behaviors that give people problems or that are viewed negatively from a social stance, we should have focused much more than we did on the kinds of interpersonal skills and social skills and living skills that people developed to help them adapt to this culture. And subsequently, we've used a number of those kinds of findings to develop employment programs for youth, to develop employment programs for former addicts and alcoholics, by looking not at their disabilities or liabilities, but rather at the kind of strengths that they manifest and what's important to them. There's an old African proverb that sums it up pretty well, that before you attempt to take away from a man that which he cherishes most and holds most dear, be sure that you have something of value with which to replace it.